day. Santa Claus comes on a Christmas day. Children run and tell their pappy on a Christmas day. Children run and tell their pappy on a Christmas day. Little children get so happy on a Christmas day. Little children get so happy on a Christmas day. Don't forget it.
Einstein at Go-Go.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Einstein at Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. You are listening to 3RRR. In the studio with me is Dr. Ray. Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Shane.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
You've been traveling all over the world.
I was. I think I missed last month. I was in the U.S. and then Sydney and then Adelaide, and I just don't want to see another airport for a good month.
Fair enough. Dr. Scarlett, good morning.
Good morning.
You haven't been traveling.
No, not in the last week, at least.
Which is good, because you have done a bit this year.
Yeah, I think we're done. We're done for the year.
You're all done? Yeah. I haven't been traveling.
You haven't been anywhere?
No. Well, earlier in the year, but not recently. Folks, we have two shows to go for the year, so this is our second last show, if you're doing the maths. We have a guest from Monash University. We're going to be talking about MRIs and all sorts of scanners. It's going to be pretty cool. A little bit later, and then Dr. Scarlett's going to do a story on, and it's a secret now.
Is a secret now.
When I say secret, it's because she told me during the week, but now I forgot. So now it's a secret, and she changed it too. So
it would have never been what I told you anyway. So
it doesn't really matter. And then I might talk a little bit about some stuff later if we have time. But we're going to start off with some news. Can I start news today?
Can Dr. Shane start news today? Dr. Shane has to start news
today. I rarely do news, but this caught my eye because I've been following this little guy, and it just cheers me up to hear this, and I want everyone to be equally cheered up. Did you hear about the drunk raccoon the other week? So this is a raccoon that over in the US, it broke into a store and got itself absolutely tanked around Thanksgiving.
Sometimes we're just having a bad day in the holidays, right?
It happens,
life's
right?
Life's tough.
It happens. Well, in latest news, and I read this in on the BBC website, which I think it's really cool that this raccoon is just getting around the world. But this raccoon that's in Virginia, and which is apparently somewhere in the US, Ray.
I used to live there.
You used to live there? Okay,
really?
So you know there's a raccoon. Yeah. There's a raccoon uprising happening. But apparently the raccoon has moved on now, and they think it's the same one that has now broken into a karate studio. I'm not sure why. Yeah, it's okay. Just working out, whatever. And also, this is the part that really, really tickled me, has also broken into the Department of Motor Vehicles for snacks.
Nothing at the karate studio.
Look, this raccoon, and I don't know, you can talk in a moment about the intelligence levels of raccoons, but it's been nicknamed Trashed Panda, which I like.
All right.
That's great.
In fairness, that's the name of a baseball team, but...
what?
Yeah, the Rocket City Trash Pandas. There's a logo and everything. You can actually order their t-shirt on Redbubble.
is this normal raccoon behavior?
Actually, the drunk part is extraordinary, but raccoons, there are a couple things you have to understand. You use the word cute guy. A raccoon, a full-size raccoon, is disturbingly large. It's not like rat size. It's like small dog size with claws, and it hisses. When I lived in Pittsburgh, we had one that lived by our dumpster, and, you know, it would hiss and look at you, and you kind of were like, do I put the trash in the bin, or do I lay it out in front of him and let him pick and choose? They can be quite big and scary, and they're not dumb. They pick up learned behavior.
We do, we talk a lot about research funding and the importance of, getting funding for important studies and so forth, and I just wanted to say, like, this raccoon is just nailing it, because apparently the county now has been selling T-shirts with the Trashed Panda logo on them, and has raised a whopping $207,000 as of last Friday. This money is going to be used to renovate a shelter, apparently, and sort of all sorts of other things. So this little, this Kung Fu Trash Panda, whatever you want to call him, raccoon, I want to know what's next. I want to know what's next. Will he infiltrate the White House? And if so, what will happen? Will anyone notice?
Yeah,
a change in leadership.
Trash
band. Actually, I think I just got banned from entering the United States by saying that.
You definitely.
It's possible. I mean, I'm probably already on that list, but maybe. Anyway. So that's my.
With your 5 years of social media, I'd be worried.
I am a little worried, but if we have time later, I'll talk about CP violation in particle physics if we've got time. But I thought the panda
this little raccoon story
was a good way to start today. So
how are we meant to top that?
Yeah, that's, I don't know how to follow Trash Panda.
That you went first.
Yeah,
good luck, suckers. You want to go next, Scarlett?
I can go next. I definitely can't top that though. All right. Well, one that caught my eye this week was about the statues on, what is Rapa Nui, hopefully saying that right, which is also known as Easter Island.
Yep.
And they have had a look into more about how these statues were carved and created, but also then how they were transported. This is a really hotly debated topic since they were first found, and this island is always sort of advertised for tourism industry as being absolutely mysterious. We don't know how they did this. How did they transport 70-ton statues across the island and then put them up? Where were they carved? How did it all work? Was it aliens? Probably is the new... No, I'm just joking. the answer is not probably.
That takes a different context after some of the material that Scarlett sent me during the week, I tell you. Was it aliens? Could have been.
Probably. I mean. But yes, there's been quite a bit of debate over this over the years. And so these researchers set out to work out, okay, let's see if we can actually get some proper evidence of what's going on here, because there are, some of the theories are quite out there. And that goes from, anything from, like, dictators, like, forcing people to do stuff to, transporting across land using, rolling logs or... sort of rudimentary, just humans dragging it, basically having a bunch of humans that are, dragging stuff across the island. So what they did was to map the volcanic crater on the island where about 95% of the statues were made and carved. And they wanted to sort of gain an understanding of whether there might be sort of one big workshop that's kind of all overseeing everything, or if there was multiple things, like what's going on is... because they're all carved in, like, a very similar way. And they use... I've actually seen this method used before, and I think it's so cool. They use drones to map things. So they took 11,000 photos of this area, and then they make a 3D model, which looks super cool. You can go and have a look at it. And that the resolution was, like, down to the centimetre, that they could look at all the little curves and structures and cliffs of this volcanic crater where these statues were carved. And for context, there's about 1,000, almost 1,000 Finnish statues on the island. But then within this crater, they also found evidence of, like, the unfinished ones too, which could give them a lot more idea of how they were made. And so in this crater, they actually, instead of what they expected to do was find maybe something that's a bit more like one big workshop running, they found evidence of about 30 workshops being undertaken there. And so, but they seem to be sort of coordinated as well. And again, how they actually work out all this stuff, that's for archaeologists to do. These are archaeologists doing this work. And for me, that was, it was amazing how they could get insight from these images and these 3D models to work out there's 30 workshops in this crater carving these statues. And then they were actually, what they think was happening by looking at the trails that the statues went along, they think that they were not transferred it, like, horizontally. So if you think about trying to transfer these big, long statues across the island, I think one of the prevailing theories is that they were transported horizontally, kind of along logs or some sort of rolling train kind of system. But I actually think they might have been transported vertically, like, so standing up. And I'm just there, like, thinking, oh, my gosh, that sounds
like the Apollo route.
Well, that's how they do the space shuttle, because it's kind of hard to, get it from down to up. So it's easier to put it on a...
So it makes more sense than I thought.
Yeah, and the Artemis rocket did a launch again early next year. Same deal.
Same deal. Are they using logs too, then?
They're going to use logs.
Well, I mean, the tractor with an axle, crawler. It's logs. Yeah, it's kind of logs with chains.
Logs with wheels and someone driving. Yeah.
So, high-tech archaeology telling us, the answers to the really big, mysterious questions.
I love that. I love it when these sorts of stories come out and we realize, the default to go to aliens is less likely than the idea that we just didn't understand these cultures as well as we think we did. And they're actually probably more ingenious than we give them credit for. And, moving really large objects is something that we're actually pretty crap at now, but they were pretty good at back then. Like, it happened a lot.
Absolutely. It did happen a lot. It's happened in a lot of different cultures, and we're just like, oh, has to be aliens, like, because we don't know how to move a big rock, so.
No. And I think, you know, like today, you know, people know what the flex is these days. Even using that term, I feel like I'm speaking to the youth audience. But, you know, like, what's a big deal these days? You know, my Bitcoin sort of thing or something or other, whereas back then maybe it was, well, you think that's a big rock. You should see the one we're moving right now.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's what they were talking about, because it's just like it's incredible engineering. I think it's fascinating, the ability to move such, you know, when you talk about 90 tons, it's like, holy crap. Yeah. That is enormous.
So what's the time scale? There's 1,000 statues on the island, right? I mean, you're talking about an intergenerational
project
making and moving of these statues.
Yeah. It sounds like they were made over like about 500 years period,
that's
like
wild.
1200 to 1700.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got the G. That's pretty good.
Nothing, sure. No big rocks, though, you know.
We could put a rock in the middle. We could. Dr. Ray, what do you got?
Interestingly, it's another thing about...
And you're right, my school story was bit enough.
Good. Oh, my goodness.
1,000 statues weighing 90 tons. This is a squirrel that drinks up
drunk.
A shop. Come on.
Well, no. I was talking about, it was a 3D mapping of ecosystems for trash pandas. No. So it is about 3D mapping. So many of you who have to live in the rental market, that's the third of us that have to rent as opposed to the third of us that are landlords. I'm in the third that rents of Australians. When you look at a plan, you see the photos, and you're trying to get your mind around how big is this place, because you know the photos are wide lens, and then all you have is that sad 2D floor plan.
Yeah.
And really trying to understand the 3D shape of a building is not always easy.
Yeah, a lot of people don't have a good concept for what 3.2 meters is. Too.
Yeah,
you know, like someone said, the bedroom is 3.2 by, you know, 2.2 meters. My immediate question is, how big's a bed? Because I know as a person, I'm getting towards 2 meters, so this doesn't sound like a big room to me.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, when they put the single bed in the picture, it's a small room.
It's a small room.
So when you come from another country and you're looking, the first thing you're saying is, what the hell does BIR mean? Because I know what a built-in robe was. A robe to me was some... Anyway.
Something you wear.
So as it turns out, you know, and some of you thinking, oh, well, Google Maps actually does 3D of buildings sometimes. Yeah. Well, actually some, and it really depends on where. And so what's happened is what came out at the start of December was a group from Technical University of Munich has made a... And it's a great name. It's Global Building Atlas. And they have effectively mapped, 3D mapped, all 2.75 billion buildings on Earth.
Whoa.
Not just in urban locations. They were very passionate about equality. So it's everything from a skyscraper in New York to a farmhouse in Kenya. And it's you can actually, if you Google Global Building Atlas, you can actually, they made it open source. All their code's on GitHub. You can actually go to a interactive website and it will overlay Google Maps and a couple of the mapping softwares. And you can actually look at every map and every 3D building and structure. And you ask, how did they do this? And some of it was LIDAR. Some of it might have been drone. Most of it was satellite mapping. And so what they did was, over quite a few cities, they actually either used satellite mapping that was 3D, or you develop machine learning algorithms to basically figure out whether or not something is 3D or not by the 2D images in the shadow. Like, if you've ever stalked your different places in the world, you always start with your own house on Google Maps, and you go, well, I know it's two stories, and I guess there's a shadow. I kind of can see it sort of 3D.
Yeah.
What they basically did is to train machine learning algorithms to extrapolate that. So if they didn't have 3D imaging, they were able to extrapolate 2D, and they've actually mapped all of the buildings in the world to a resolution about a 3x3 meter cube. So it's enough to tell height and general volume. And this is fascinating for a number of different reasons. I remember talking to civil engineers years ago that said one of the biggest problems in buildings and councils is they're 2D. And I thought, you're joking, right? It's 2D. I know we and rentals, we get that crappy plan. But that's actually kind of what councils do. You might think architects have 3D buildings, but councils don't have the necessarily always have that information and background. So in urban planning, this is transformational. But the other thing that's fascinating about this is I love the professor that came up with it. She actually introduced a new term to think about housing, and it's volume per capita.
Oh, right.
It's a very interesting way to think about how you capture wealth, because volume, larger volumes per capita correlate with wealth, higher densities, lower volumes. Mm. It also can then give you an insight into both urbanization, energy uptake, CO2, and urban planning. And if you start, and what this professor wants to do is, the next step is to do this over time, to really understand growth, to understand how growth has happened, and maybe interventions before things get too crowded. But the idea of volume per capita is a very interesting way to characterize buildings and wealth. And so it's fascinating, and I already, of course, looked up my own home. It looked like it got it right. I was going to look for mansions out, you know, in far, the West to find Dr. Shane's house, but I didn't have the chance.
I think you wouldn't find mine.
No.
If you're looking for mansions and you're looking for my house,
I should have checked that too. It's fascinating, and they did it as open access, and it's a useful tool for planning. They think the UN's going to be able to use it a lot, and it's a very interesting way to start thinking about the world, and it's not Google Maps or anything. It's actually something anyone can use.
I like it. I want the day when our phones are just, you know, because your phone could even now probably actually determine its signal strength based on the room you're in and actually map the interior of any structure. And that would be cool.
Wasn't that a Batman movie with echolocation?
Yeah, standard stuff. No, you're actually right. It did happen. But that sort of idea has been around for a long time. And I think, you know, the idea of you walking through a house that you're viewing and your phone just mapping it. And then when you get home, you can actually say, oh, this is what they actually look like and what's going to fit. And that, I think, would be cool too, but I like the idea of all these 3D structures. I'm one of those sort of very anxious people. When I go to a new location, I like to know where the door is, where I get in. That, so you know, I'm often on Street View, you know, just looking at where the entrance to places is and so forth, so that I'm prepared. Yeah. I like to be prepared.
This all over with Google Maps. Imagine having this and then looking at Street View at the same time.
Yeah,
it gives a new dimension.
Yeah, very good. Volume per capita. I like it, folks. We're going to take a break for some music. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with our first and only guest for today, and most likely our last guest for the year, actually, because next week I don't think we'll have any guests.
Oh, wow.
We'll be talking amongst ourselves. Here's some tunes. You're listening to Einstein and Gago on 3RRR.
Follow me. But I won't let you in.
Play your cards, I hit back hard.
Our cuts don't break the skin.
I wish you well, if you can't tell.
You're doing my head in.
I wouldn't change
about this love-hate relationship.
It's so hard, we have it wrong.
But I won't let you in.
Play your cards, I hit back hard.
Our cuts don't break the skin.
I wish you well, if you can't tell.
Veins. You're the poison that I need. You're the lock and I'm the key. Oh.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Einstein the Go-Go on 3RRR. In the studio now, we have Professor Christoph Hagemeyer. Christoph is from Monash University. He's actually the director of the Monash Biomedical Imaging Unit and is the group leader at the Department of Diabetes at the Monash School of Translational Medicine. Christoph, did I miss anything?
No, that covers it. two hats.
So, like, is that like a 14-day week? Like,
it feels like it sometimes. Yeah.
Now we got you in because I saw some stuff coming out of Monash over the last couple of weeks around your new MRI system. I think can you just run through for our listeners where the MRI systems sit in terms of historically? Because I think most people have probably had their head in a 3 Tesla MRI system, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
So where are we, and what's the deal with the new one?
So it's also a 3 Tesla system, and that's the standard clinically. There are some 7 Tesla systems as well. So one is at Melbourne University and one is up in Queensland. And they're really focused on neuroscience and this system as well. What's special about this one is it has very high gradients, so magnetic gradients, which gives you more speed and also higher resolution. Yeah. It came from what is called the Connectome project, which was an international consortium of trying to understand the brain connectivity in more detail. Yeah. So these were experimental scanners, which were in the US and in Europe. Yep. There was none in Australia at the time. And this project was so successful of really interrogating the fine connection between neurons that Siemens decided to make that into a commercial product.
Right,
and that's the Xema X now.
Interesting. So because, I mean, one of the things that, you know, for those of us who might or might not be, could be asking for a friend, are a little claustrophobic. Like being stuck in that tube for 30 to 60 minutes is not always the most comfortable thing. So how long, like, what's the transition to these new ones? What's the timing?
So it's an interesting trade-off because the scanner we had before was the Siemens Skyra, which has a 70-centimeter bore. Mm-hmm. This one has a 60-centimeter bore. So we are going actually 10 centimeters smaller. Okay. So it feels much more claustrophobic.
Wait, some of us are trying to think of their general scientist size and 60-centimeter bore going. Anyway, going on.
Yeah, so but the advantage is it's much faster. So it's scan would usually take 30 minutes, will only take 5 minutes. So you're stuck in there for far shorter period of time. Yeah. So I think it's a good trade-off.
Yeah. With that timing, though, presumably, like, you're talking about a change in temporal resolution, effectively, of the scanner. So, like, the distance between each image frame is much different on something that does the whole job in 5 minutes and 30 minutes. So presumably there must be processes in the brain that happen too fast for the old scanners that you can now see. Is that right?
Correctly. Yeah, exactly. So you can really see changes in functional MRI much, much faster and much more detail. Mm. So it's about really the connect. So the people in the scanner usually look at the monitor and you can display pictures and movies on the display. And then you can read out what actually the brain is doing with this information.
Yeah.
So that's called functional MRI, which is really the core of this technology.
Yeah, that's the fun stuff. And correct me if I'm wrong, but did I read a few years back that there were some experiments done with functional MRI where you could work out that we were making decisions in our brain before we were consciously aware of them?
Yeah, I think there are some interesting projects going on at Monash in the psychedelic space. So we have BrainPark there as well, which is funded by the Turner Foundation, And we were actually pioneering this work with ketamine and psilocybin dosing for trauma and things like that. And we're finding out a lot of interesting links between what's conscious lead decision and what's non-conscious. There's also one other interesting study on flavor and juices. So right. people get strawberry or pineapple juice, and you can see what they're like or not. Probably before that, before they know what they're like. In
this
a way,
like a lie detector.
Exactly. So some of the big food companies are very interested in this to really have an objective measure of what kind of makes you addictive to certain foods. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not.
They already spend an awful lot of time in biometric sensing. So when you go to a sensor panel and say you like it or not, they've got thermal imaging cameras, eye temperature, facial micro expressions, everything to see what your body says you like, regardless of what you write down to say you're like. So the idea of their dream would be getting in your brain.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
I
eat a pineapple a week to keep my voice good for the show.
Oh.
And I believe that I could beat any lie detector if it asked me how much I like pineapples. I don't know. That's amazing stuff. Yeah. Now, a lot of your work, Christoph, is based around essentially, you know, new sorts of pharmaceutical interventions for various diseases and so forth, and how that is tracked with a system like this. So talk us through what you're trying to do there, because I think, you know, this new MRI gives you a completely different, you know, scope of potential practice with regards to what you can and cannot monitor.
Absolutely. And that's my second hat. So my main hat is director of Monash Biomedical Imaging, where we provide service in all image modalities, including MRI, across all species, basically. In my lab, we are really interested in diagnosis of cardiovascular disease, but also in diabetes treatment and these kind of things. And I think in the cardiovascular space, there's a lot of potential for MRI, because you can really see plaques, for example, which are potential to cause heart attacks and strokes in much greater detail. And that's also something which is a big advantage for people who have cardiovascular disease, have comorbidities usually. So they're going into the scanner, they have a quick scan much faster than the previous system. So there's a lot of synergies with my work. In the lab.
Yeah, interesting. Can I ask you, because this seems to me to be more of a cost thing than a scientific choice, but we seem to always, in medicine, in many areas of medicine, default to CT scans before we go for MRIs. And often, you know, I've heard many, many clinicians say, you know, we'll see what we can see in the CT scan. We've seen nothing, we'll go to the MRI. And I think, well, why don't you just start there? Like, it is such a more sophisticated instrument, and there is no radiation dose to the body. So what's the limiting factor?
I think for longitudinal studies, you have to go to MRI because, as you said, you can't really do subsequent CTs for a long time because the burden is too high. They're imaging certain things better. I think CT is very good for bone and for heart structures. Yep. MRI is better for soft tissue structure. I would agree that MRI is a better opportunity because you also can have contrast, and that's something we're developing in the lab.
Yeah.
So iron oxide or gadolinium-based contrast agents, which give you really a molecular readout of what's going on, and you don't have that in CT. CT is not a molecular modality. MRI is more, and PET, so radio pharmaceutical imaging, is then the molecular method.
I remember it many years ago when I was before I did any of my PhD, my honors degree, I had the option of doing that with a professor named Gary Egan, who you may or may not know, and that was when PET scanning was like just starting. I think it was out the Austin.
Yeah.
And like no one really knew what it was, but everyone was excited. I chose astrophysics instead, but it's a different story. But
it's a very interesting story because the role I'm in now is Gary Egan's former role. So Gary Egan founded Monash Biomedical Imaging as the founding director 12 years ago. And when I was called to take over the facility, he stayed on as a strategic advisor, but he retired last week officially.
Oh, wow. That's
amazing. So we had a really, really amazing farewell for him. And he has been a pioneer in this area.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you something that's not going to happen today, Christoph, but when Gary first came on the show, you know, some 30-odd years ago, whenever it was, the deal I made with him was that I would be one of his guinea pigs in one of the first PET imaging systems, and the guy had me hooked up to this thing for like 2 hours. It was not a good deal for me.
Yeah,
it was a terrible deal. He gave a really good interview. It was really interesting stuff because we'd not even heard of PET imaging back then.
Yeah.
And, but, oh, yeah, I mean, I really sacrificed a lot. But I did find out I didn't have any tumors in my head, which was kind of good.
So you went in there with radioactivity to get a PET scan. Oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it was kind of, you know, part of that, they were looking for recruits to help them develop the system and so forth. And so the PET imaging system is partly based on my busted brain. So
we always need volunteers. So if anyone is interested to come and go onto our MRI or other systems, you're more than welcome.
Yeah. We need average population, not just, you know. So Shane's,
when it
Shane's
comes to MRI, if you need a hand or a foot, I'm your guy. If you want a head, that's someone else. You can talk to Scarlett. She might be. I'm not doing that. No, I mean, they're good. The system's good, but I'm always happy to hear it because there's so many people who can't handle the noise and the confinement MRIs, and getting the faster ones is actually a real advantage because people are avoidant of, you know, many health checks as a result of those parameters.
The noise is an issue as well. You usually have earplugs in because it's very loud. And then if you only have 5 minutes instead of 30, it's also a big relief.
Yeah. I remember a million years ago talking to my long gone grandmother when she said, Shane, do I have to worry about this scanner? Like, is it dangerous? Back when it was called a nuclear magnetic resonance imaging machine. And I said, don't worry about the word nuclear. There's nothing in there that can hurt you. It's the one type of scan, or other than ultrasound, that actually doesn't damage your body when you have it. Which
correct.
Is
kind of, yeah, correct.
It's kind of lovely. Now, Crystal, before we let you go, talk us through some of the sort of these targeted molecular probe things that you're working on as well, because I find that fascinating. What are you doing there? What are you trying to achieve?
So it's mainly in the cardiovascular space. So we're really trying to detect vulnerable, unstable plaques first, and we use antibodies or peptides to bring nanoparticles to plaques and to really highlight where the issue is. And then physicians can put in like a stent or give aggressive medical therapy to really try to avoid a heart attack or a stroke before it happens. You know? So that's really the gist of it. MRI has not like a really strong signal. PET is usually the modality you would go for something like this. And there's a lot of interest in, you probably heard about theranostic imaging, where you have a radio tracer which can be used as a diagnostic tool and at the same time another radio tracer which is similar for therapy. So that's something which is mainly in cancer, but also in cardiovascular. There are a lot of opportunities for this.
Interesting.
So I was trying to understand how this all fits in bioimaging. What I'm assuming is using MRI or PET or CAT, so you're doing live things or for full tissue, does that connect back to the things researchers do more of pathology or slicing tissues or microscopy? How do those tools come into play with what you're doing, or your ability is to look at things in a live setting?
Absolutely. I think people are underestimating the power of imaging. So I think in research, but also in clinical work, people are still doing lumpology, as they call it, like that they take biopsies out of kidneys, out of livers, and things like that. With sophisticated molecular imaging, you don't need to do that anymore, because you have a molecular tracer, you inject, it finds the target, it shows up as a signal in the liver or in the kidney, and you can distinguish what the underlying cause of disease is. I think we should really move away from too much invasive biopsies and histology also in research, because we can do, with imaging we can do a lot of things non-invasively.
I was amazed recently. I had a calcium score done,
which very is important.
Incredible sort of technique, where my understanding is they put a contrast dye into your heart, and it's a CT scan, you know, so it is an X-ray, you know, or 1,000 X-rays. But they're able to map out, you know, how much plaque is on the arteries of your heart, which is an incredible piece of information.
So usually you don't get a contrast in the calcium score. So you get a contrast if you do an angiogram. So you have an iodinated contrast where you can see a narrowing of the vessel,
right,
which is usually not a good predictor of a heart attack or a stroke down the track. Mm. A calcium score usually won't use contrast.
Right.
It's just looking at the calcification of your plaque. So how much calcium is in your plaque. And CT is very powerful.
Mm.
But a calcium score, I'm not sure how long yours was taking. It takes a few minutes.
Yeah, it wasn't very long. Yeah.
So it's a very quick scan.
Yep.
And everyone who's concerned about his cardiovascular health at a certain age should get a calcium score.
Yeah.
It's our best tool to predict your risk of cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, and strokes.
Yeah.
It's really quick, non-invasive, a little bit of radiation, of course, but no contrast and no injection and things like that.
Very powerful. I found it fascinating because I like to approach my health scientifically. And so the question is, do you go on a statin to reduce your cholesterol or do you not? And, you know, is it a problem or is it not? And the third piece of information you really need is, what does your heart calcification look like now? Because if it's really, really bad, you know, as your starting point, well, you need to do something immediately. Whereas if it's actually really good at a starting point, then your options are a bit more flexible. And I think that data out of the calcium score was really helpful for that.
Yeah, so I had a calcium score, my first one, 10 years ago. It was zero. Last was, I think this year, was zero. So I think you wouldn't be worried about that if your calcium score is zero. And it's such a low-cost, quick assay that I think, people who can do it, I think I would just go to your GP and say, can I have a calcium score
if you're concerned. Yeah, it's well worthwhile. And it's as you say, it's a quick test. And I spent a lot more time in the waiting room than I did in the scanner. And when I said that, I mean, a lot more time in the waiting room. It was, and then there was the waiting room that you go to next before you get into the actual scanner. But it was all, but the scanner thing was a bit a non-event.
It was not too bad.
The last thing I wanted to ask you, Christoph, before you go is, I've seen recently, and I'm a bit health anxious, which I think is good because I do things like calcium scores, but I've learned that you can now privately pay for full body MRI scans. Like, there's some companies out there that are selling this. Is this the sort of thing that we, like, I guess the question is it valuable or do those sorts of scans always find something?
I think it's a personal decision, but there are a lot of companies also to do genetic testing, like wide-range genetic testing, and that could potentially be valuable for you to really see if you have any hereditary conditions or things like that. But of course, you have to pay it out of pocket and privately. But it's definitely for someone who is aware of their health, a good option to get peace of mind. What's out there? I think it's a personal decision. There's definitely value in this, and with the advent of AI and like fast image processing, if you get an MRI every, let's say, 5 years or so, and with high powered computing, you potentially look at changes, subtle changes in the body, which can predict something which a radiologist will not be able to pick up by just looking at pictures over time.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of potential for AI and for fast compute in the future, in image analysis and in imaging.
Christoph, I've got to tell you, if I had your job, I'd be scanning myself once a month. Probably good that I don't have your job. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting to
us.
Can
I just quickly thank National Imaging Facility and the federal government's NCRIS funding system? We're not talking about funding today, but Australian research and science is grossly underfunded, and it's always good to have these win stories that you get federal and Monash and state support for equipment like this, which is not cheap, and getting that out for research is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think anyone who is having a scan, lucky enough to be in that scanner and getting it done in 5 minutes, good, well done. Because I think it'd be nice to see these spread all over the country, because it does help a lot of people to have that quicker, you know, less sort of,
absolutely,
I don't want to use the word invasive, but it can be a troubling experience for some people.
Yeah.
So Christoph, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Have a good last few weeks to the year.
Yeah, thank you.
Folks, we're going to take a short break for some station announcements, and when we come back, Scarlett's talking about some special secret she's been preparing. I'm not sure.
Don't,
I have no idea.
Pump it up too much.
We're beefing it up. It's going to be the best thing you've
heard
all year.
It's going to be better than Trash Pandas.
It's going to be better than the Trash Pandas.
Every year, thousands of women and children in Melbourne face homelessness, many escaping family violence and sleeping in unsafe places. Launch Housing provides more than shelter. They offer safety, support, and a path forward to help families heal and rebuild through crisis accommodation and long-term housing. Everyone deserves a safe night's sleep. This festive season, make a donation to help provide safety and a fresh start. Visit donate.launchhousing.org.au. Triple R sponsors.
Urgent, timely and gripping. Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5, explores the immortal legacy of one of literature's most enduring writers.
When I sit down to write a book, I write it because there is some lie that I want to expose.
Combining scenes from adaptations of George Orwell's Animal Farm with real-world footage, this immersive documentary is an exploration of both Orwell's own life and the one we find ourselves in now.
The love in the air, I've never seen anything like it.
Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5, screens exclusively at Cinema Nova from December 25th. Triple R sponsors.
John Nixon, Song of the Earth, 1968 to 2020, is now open at Heidi. Experience Nixon's extraordinary oeuvre of abstract art through a selection of works from 5 decades. This is the first exhibition to chart the legacy of this significant Australian artist through key moments in his practice. Song of the Earth runs until March 9, 2026 at Heidi Museum of Modern Art. Triple R sponsors.
Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor star in The History of Sound, a cinematic romance for the ages. Two young music students attending the Boston Conservatory in 1917 bond over their shared love of folk music. They reconnect a few years later, embarking on a song-collecting trip in the backwaters of Maine.
Sound is invisible, but it can be physical. It can touch something, it can make an impression.
The History of Sound. In cinemas only, December 18. Universal Pictures Australia, Triple R sponsors.
Journey into the cosmos with a full-dome film experience at Melbourne Planetarium Scienceworks. See the universe expand through stunning imagery of astronomical events and artistic visuals created specifically for the 360-degree dome. Sit back with a drink in hand and enjoy an out-of-this-world cinema experience like no other at Planetarium Nights. Every Friday night at the Melbourne Planetarium, ScienceWorks. Book tickets from museumsvictoria.com.au. Triple R sponsors.
Welcome back, folks. It is, we've got 19 minutes. There's so much of the show left. I don't even know where to start. So we're going to start with you, Dr. Scarlett, because you've been preparing something for at least 24 hours.
Well, you'd think, no. I have, but as you said, I did go back and forth on the stories. Yeah. I went from like the whales attacking the ships, the orcas,
which I was excited about,
but you forgot.
Yeah, I forgot.
So
yeah.
Not that excited.
What about whales and dolphins hunting tuna together?
Yeah,
which also was disturbing because normally the whales hunt the tuna.
People talk about long term and short term memory. Mm. I've got one in the middle, which is kind of like it's not quite in either. But if I wait long enough, it will come back into my short-term memory. And that's where your stuff was, in the middle.
In the middle, the grey zone. It's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, right? It exists or, you know, you have to open the box to see if the memory's still there.
I know I have the knowledge, but I don't get to access it at the time of my choosing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I probably shouldn't have mentioned the whale story because this is like maybe a bit less interesting. Do you know, my mind went, whales and whale behaviour. Shane's going to think that's too close to my work. Let me try something different.
Close to bees? And,
close to bees?
I guess I know. Behavior.
Because one's a mammal and one's a bug that can fly, so...
Whales can get a bit of height out of the water when they preach.
Yeah, I mean, sure, the dancing's more about... Anyway.
I wish I knew it was that specific. Okay, well, I could have done whales. Yeah. Next time.
Yep.
But
you say that, but he may have forgotten that and come up for a way to criticize next time.
Well, what I've got now is I tried to do something different, and then I realized, no, that's still something I work on, which is hilarious. We're going to talk about numeral systems.
Number systems?
Yeah. I know, I realized afterwards, I was like, oh, no, you're pitching this to physicists.
No.
I mean, both of you
it's been a long time.
Well, let's
I'm still an engineer. I'm not outdated to what I was trained in.
Yeah, sorry, but you're both good at maths, right? So let's see how I pitch this. I mean, your opinions on this are going to be really interesting because we're going to talk about numeral systems, but also base numbers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The history of base, or a little bit of the history of base numbers 10. In human, well, yeah. Not only base 10, right?
No, yeah.
But for people who don't really know what that means is, I've got a little example for you. So for me, someone not so great at maths, if I take 2.4 litres and I want to say how many millilitres are in that, that's easy for me. That's 2,400. Good, set. That's because it's base 10. I've grown up in an English-speaking household. That base 10 is what we use in English for the most part. And, yeah, that's a really easy calculation. However, if you then ask me to do, how many minutes in 2.4 hours... I would be a little bit stumped. I'd be like, can I please go get a calculator? Because hours, minutes, seconds, they're done in base 60. So 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour.
Yeah.
But if you also give me a decimal place, the decimal place is a base 10. So you've mixed two together now.
Yeah,
if you've
it's tough.
Got 2.4, you've got a mix of base 60 and base 10. And that confuses my brain.
Yeah, fair. So, fair. Totally fair.
So for the most part, probably most people listening to this are going to be, on a base 10 system for, a lot of the way they live their lives. But it's not the only system that exists out there, which is really interesting. A few of the things I learned when I was researching this was base 12 is something a lot of people like to push. And my mind goes, base 12, how do you do that? But apparently because you can divide it by like 2, 3, 4 and 6.
Yeah, half a dozen.
It makes it really...
Third of a dozen, quarter of a dozen, quarter of a pound.
Yeah.
Calendars.
Yeah. There's some nice stuff around base 12.
Yeah. Calendars are messed up, though, because the months are 12, but the days are kind of base 10.
Yeah, and I think if we had 13 months rather than 12, they'd all be exactly the same length or some
humans.
Weird stuff like that. We screwed
made
up.
Made it better.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite one that I always mess up, though, but is useful, is binary. So base 2.
Yeah, base 2.
Base 2. I mean, so base systems are usually, they are over 1. So you've got to be over 1 to have a base system. Another one that's been, pitched is 5 because we have
five fingers.
And we learn to count, a lot of us, on our fingers, and so it makes a lot of sense. So it's kind of interesting how 10 became the base system.
Yeah.
But...
I could go a base 5 system. I reckon it'd be cool.
Money technically works on that now that we get rid of the penny. Sorry.
I mean, we haven't had the penny in ages, or ever.
Well,
the penny. Not in your lifetime. I think it might have been still lurking around a little bit when I was born, but that had been replaced by the cent.
Yeah, well, it's...
The cent.
Yeah.
Well, what got me interested about this is there was a special issue months ago that I read about in Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, and it was a whole special issue of review papers, so reviews of the literature, opinion pieces, so really strong people's opinions, and then research articles on base number systems in humans. And apparently it's a really controversial area about what's the natural one, what are people using, how it's influenced by language and culture and all of that sort of stuff. And I read through it and I just thought, this is fascinating. Obviously, my link there that I realised was I do B's in mathematics. And so I realised I'm still looking at something that's a little bit close to me. But it was absolutely fascinating to see all the opinions and actually see the controversies that exist and how hotly debated they are. Now, one of the things you might be wondering, if you're not Ray or Shane and know all about base number systems, is why we actually need them. And it's because of our memories, which links very well to what you said before. But if we can't name every single number that exists separately. Like, we can't just have a different name for every number. We need a system that allows us to scale up. Imagine trying to have a different name for, numbers 1 to infinity.
Yeah. In English, we're really crap at this too.
There's some worse languages I'm going to talk about.
Because, why isn't it called 1-teen or 2-teen?
Yes.
Or 3-teen, 14. Oh, we got that one right.
Yep.
15, sorry, no. 16. Oh, bingo. 17, 18, 19.
Is that from Roman? Because we have
I don't know.
but when not in Roman numerals, but in Latin, you have 10 and then 1, 10 and then 2, and then you have 13.
I get it. I get it. But, we could fix this right now. 1-teen.
One teen.
Doesn't it sound silly, though? I mean,
sounds like
obviously,
something you'd eat, like
it's
Ovaltine.
Easier to sell Trash Panda than one teen. but
I mean, yeah, so English is done in base 10, because you can see, except for the exceptions that Shane just mentioned, you know, we've got 10, 20, 30, 40, and then we've got, you know, 110, 100. Things generally make sense, except that little bit there where we go one teen.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the actual perspective, which is interesting, you picked up on this, that I've taken today is the linguistic side. So this special issue of papers went all over the place. It did anthropology, it did, you know, computer science, mathematics and that sort of thing. But the linguistic side was really fascinating. So, as I said, like our language is, we can compose like 342 using 3 times the second power of 10, which is 100, and 4 times the first power of 10. Yeah, we've kind of got that settled. And so if we have a look at languages that have what's called like less transparent rules, they actually take children longer to learn if they're coming from a language where they don't have really strong base number rules, which is quite interesting. So it takes them longer to process, and it can lead to like more errors and, yeah, just longer to learn maths. I took a long time to learn maths, and I have no excuses. I had a language 10. That had base 10. Yeah.
So we also often have problems processing large numbers, you know, telling the difference between 1,000 and 100,000 people when we look at it. Is part of that because our language doesn't actually really go to those scales as well?
Mm-hmm.
When we, you know, you wouldn't, if you're doing bartering, you know, you're never going to sell more than 100 fish at a time. Do you really need a language that's going to cover thousands of fish? Is that where part of that comes from?
I mean, this is where, you know, like we quickly move into, even as researchers, we move into scientific notation because we don't like it either. And it takes too long to write.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
we don't represent them well.
Yeah, we write in a different notation because, like, you don't want to write something that has 27 zeros. I'm not doing that. My eyesight would go blurry.
Yeah. They could be part of it because now we're representing more and more bigger numbers, obviously, in modern society. But back then, if you're talking about, bartering for goods, we probably never were representing, you know, billions of dollars.
Yeah. I want 1 billion potatoes, please.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of languages that actually don't have specific words for numbers, and they're actually using things like a few, some, and many.
Right.
And, you know, then things get, I mean, there's research now, and that was part of this, some of the research I did into this, is to looking at, well, what bases are they using, which is very interesting. But if we go to French, the French language, they do something kind of ridiculous. I live there. I try to learn French. It went poorly. I'm not going to say it in French because no one wants me to hear that. But they are also base 10, like us.
Yep.
But then they do things a bit weird between 70 and 99. They go, so 70 for them is actually expressed as 6 times 10 plus 10.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And then you go to 80 and they switch to having 20 as a base number. So they've just gone from 10, base 10 to base 20. And they're saying 4 20s. And then 90 is 4 20 plus 10.
I wonder if that was based off the back of a currency thing. You know, like, so when you're paying for something, I'm going to give you four $20 bills or francs. And the next piece, you know, I wonder if some of those notations a long time ago were based off some sort of currency examples.
But French, Italian, Roman, and Romanian are Romance languages, they're based off Latin, and Latin doesn't do that. Like that's just French.
Well, what does Latin do?
Well,
is it base 10?
It's base 10.
Yeah.
And for 70 and 80, it would just be 70 and 80.
Yeah. Okay. Mm.
It'd be, well, I mean the numeral part, but you would just say 80. When you get to 100, 90 sometimes. When you get to 9, sometimes it's 10 minus 1. Mm. So it could be...
Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah. Okay. But, I'm thinking Roman numerals,
Yeah, so no, Roman numerals would be 50 plus 10.
They do
10.
Weird stuff there.
Yeah, but the language part would have just been octave something.
Right.
You know, it would
numerals and the language are quite different there.
A little bit.
Well, not quite different, but sometimes.
Yeah, but the thing French is doing is not how Latin works for them.
Mm.
So that's interesting.
Well, then Germany also did a weird thing. I'm just like taking shots at all the languages. And as you pointed out, English has not done its best either. But the numbers going from 13 to 99 are expressed with the ones before the tens. But once you get to 100, they switch back to saying the largest number first. Like
yeah,
us.
Interesting.
So there's a whole lot of things. But
I mean, in Australia, when we're talking about currency, you know, I'm going to give you a pineapple or a tomato. And people know a lot of people listening know exactly what I'm talking about.
No, the foreigner just asked. Say that again.
Poor Ray from America is like, what the hell? Well, a $50 note's a pineapple and a 20 is a tomato. How do you not know this? Because you've lived in the digital world, Ray.
Actually, it was your accent just kind of blubbed together. Pineapple, tomato. Okay, yeah, the colors.
There we go.
Right. So, coming back to
the actual story.
But, basically, like a couple of studies, one done in 2010, one done in 2020, just basically found similar things, which was, a lack of transparency of what the base number is slows down learning numbers and language and that sort of thing. And more transparent languages actually allow kids to better represent large numbers. So that was also very cool. And start, if you think of an abacus or, the kids' toys, they can more quickly learn to represent, this block means 10. Yep. And I can put three big blocks together, that's 30, and two little blocks together, and now that's 32.
Yep.
And kids can get that way quicker when it's transparent.
Is there any language that's favored something other than base 10?
I think there's base 6 in, I'm trying to think of the language, but yes. Yeah, there's quite a few that do other bases.
You can get used to it.
Yeah, I think you just need to be thinking in that way.
Nice stuff.
So the last bit I'm just going to mention is the applicability of this, which is, at a cultural level, this really makes a difference. So base representation influences our ability to collaborate with each other. And when you have two societies using different bases or different numeral systems and you can't communicate that well, bad things happen. So one of the examples was with the Mars Climate Orbiter incident, where we got a little bit of a mix-up between metric and imperial units, and that caused the spacecraft worth $327 million to crash into Mars back in the 90s. So.
That was the poundle. What's even worse is wasn't just that it was metric imperial. The poundle, which is this acceleration unit defined in imperial units, there's two different versions of it. So even when the New York Times tried to explain what went wrong, they got it wrong.
That's
so it's just bizarre. But yeah, that's a brilliant example of base 10 versus whatever the hell else the imperial units are. But
what do we call imperial units? What base is that? Is that a base?
It's base 12.
Is it base 12?
Yeah, but acceleration is 32.
Yeah. So. It's weird. It's just bits and pieces. You're using hands at one point.
That's why we make it base 5.
No, I mean hands as a measure.
And horsepower.
Thanks, Scarlett. We're going to take a brief break for some station announcements before we come back.
Just announced at the Northcote Theatre, Nightmares on Wax, Bikrunga, Obongya, Judith Hill, Catatonia and Iron and Wine. Plus, High Times New Year's Eve, featuring Bradley Zero, Waxo Paradiso, DJ Jeanette and more. Also in the calendar, Furnace and the Fundamentals Festive Season Show, Nuria, The Brian Jonestown Massacre, Helmet, Electric Six and Transvision Vamp. All shows on sale now from northcotetheatre.com. RRR sponsors.
Coming up at Arts Centre Melbourne this December. Parcels, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, Sarah Landry, Loyal Kana, Dominic Fike, New Year's at the Bowl and more, all at Sydney My Music Bowl. And for the festive spirit, see the hilarious drag parody of Fountain Lake's Christmas Carol. Or have a Grinch Stole Christmas and Home Alone live in concert with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. Tickets at artscentremelbourne.com.au. RRR sponsors.
Yeah, we're back. I just want to tell you guys something. First of all, next week is our last show, I should say. Last show for the year. Not last show. Last show for the year. I have to qualify that. It's going to be cool. We're going to talk about a lot of science that's been exciting to us all year round. But I wanted to mention you to a piece of another piece of news which I saw, which was pretty cool this week, was from a group of archaeologists in England who have been doing work around Neanderthals and some of the stuff that they were getting up to. And they found this. They've been working on this site, which has been of interest for quite a while. But in this site, they've found these small quantities of iron pyrite, which is basically fool's gold, and flint. Now, one of the things that a lot of people will probably be aware of is when you whack these two things together, you get sparks and you can make fire. Right? Now, we didn't really think of Neanderthals as doing that early on. And this has been dated back about 400,000 years. The cool part, of course, and this is the part that's really I find really interesting in these sorts of explorations of ancient culture, is that there's a big difference between using fire and deliberately bringing fire to a location. So, when there's a wildfire, you get to use fire. And if you're good enough, you might be able to carry around some fire for a bit and keep it going. You know, that's something that probably happened long before this. But if you turn up to a place with your flint and your fool's gold, that's very different. You are actively taking fire to a location where it normally doesn't exist, which allows you to go into colder spaces. It also allows you to cook food. And when you cook food, it becomes more digestible, which means you have more protein, more capability to actually feed your brain. And over a longer period of time, cultures have, you know, more fuel for their brain, tended to evolve into, you know, higher thinking individuals. But anyway, they've published this in Nature just on December 10. And it kind of potentially pushes back this idea of what Neanderthals were actually up to and capable of by quite a bit. And it may be that they were one of the first ones to actually start the whole fire thing, and they may have actually given it to everyone else. So, you know, that old, you know, we used to say that Neanderthals were not that bright, like, well and truly gone now.
Yeah.
And these humans, pseudo-humans, were, like, incredible in some of the things that they were doing back in Europe. 400,000 years ago. So anyway, these sites are fascinating. I think that, you know, they find these small bits of materials. Iron pyrite's not locally found in this region, so they knew that they brought it in, which is kind of the key to the whole puzzle.
Yes, it sounds very hard to work out. I read this story as well, article, and it sounds very hard to work out what is man-made fire and what is not man-made fire, but the pyrite has been the key to this, right? Yeah.
So you've got to have the tool to make it, you know, human-made, I'm going to say.
Neanderthal-made.
and the fact, you know, there's some cool stuff there. So anyway, we have to go. Thanks, guys. I'm going to say see you next week, folks. Remember, science is everywhere. We're going to hand over now to the team from Eat It. Have a great Sunday, and we'll chat soon.
Melbourne Radio. Subscriber Radio. Triple R FM. Is that it? 102.7. Yeah, that's it for the moment.
Hey, guys. Why don't we eat?
Dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm having spam, spam, spam.
Cornflakes!
Anyone fancy a pint?
Suit you, sir.
Spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam!
I said I don't want any beer and vegetables.
Lentils are really good, you know?
Forbidden donut.